Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 61 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. What do you do?
My name is Basil Farrington. I play bass, produce, and compose.
So do people confuse it by saying Basil Basil? Do you get that a lot?
Absolutely. That's like from the first day in kindergarten. People are used to saying Basil because of the seasoning, but I was named after my father's best friend in high school, and he was Basil, so that's me.
Yeah, it's a very European name, actually, when you think about it.
Oh, yeah. I'm common in London. Not so common in America.
Not so common in America. And yet, so born and raised as a Philly boy.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm always fascinated with this sort of interesting role I've had for the past 5 years, which is having conversations with amazing bass players and musicians. And I was getting prepared for our conversation, and I know that prior to playing bass, you had done music lessons and playing on the trumpet and French horn. And I don't know if you know this, but it is common that many of the greater bass players started off playing trumpet and French horn. I don't know why that is, but it seems to be a commonality on this show.
Wow, that is amazing. You did your homework. I didn't think too many people knew that. Yeah, I played, because I came into the world with I have two older brothers. Both were musically inclined. One is 8 years older. The other is 10 years older. So when I came in, I was surrounded by their music. And because of it, even in the first grade, when all the other kids were writing with crayons, were drawing wagons and gates and trees and that kind of stuff, I was drawing the treble clef on the piece of paper, and I knew what the notes were because that's what was surrounding me at home. So by the time I was in the fourth grade, they realized that I had a talent that was a little bit above normal. They took me down to be tested by the orchestra teacher, and the first instrument was trombone, then it was trumpet, and French horn.
And so how old are you at the time?
We're talking elementary school, so 10, 11, somewhere in there.
And are we comfortable talking about how old you are, just so we can also put this in the context of what generation and decade we're talking about?
Sure. I was born August 1st, 1954. That makes me 65, and that is tough to say, man.
My father passed, about 6 years ago, and he was in his later 70s, and he wasn't really sick at all. It was a sort of sudden thing, but he would always tell me that, like, he would look in the mirror and he's like, "I just don't feel how I look." It was his line.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's tough to say it, but I've gotten to the point where, okay, yeah, I'm 65. I can admit it.
So you're 11 years old. I'm assuming it's a public school. Is it a private school?
Oh yeah. Public school.
What is it like in Philly at that time, being in the public school system? Was it tough? Was it middle class? Where were you at, and what was it like? Because I always imagine, the kids who sort of are knighted to a certain degree with music skills, sometimes it's not easy to be that kid.
Not only was I that kid as far as music is concerned, I was that kid academically. I was always taller. I didn't meet anybody as tall as, I'm not a giant. I'm 6'3", but I didn't meet anybody as tall as I was until I got to the eighth grade. So I was taller.
They caught up.
Academically, the teachers loved me. I was a bit of a star, a bit of a prodigy, even athletically. I was more dominant than everybody else. And there's always that person in school who is quicker, is just a hair better than everybody else. And I was sort of that person. So for me, it was a great time. You know, I was always acknowledged by teachers and everything, and I had a real, really, really good time in many respects, much better than right now.
What does that mean?
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
No, because when you're at that age, you don't know
how good it is.
The things that you know now.
Right.
And you know, the things that you grow with, they aren't all totally pleasant.
So what was happening musically? I'm curious because I come from a family where I had a younger brother and two older brothers, and there's no doubt that a lot of my musical tastes and influence is forged by having older siblings, especially with the age gap that you had with your two siblings. They're obviously feeding the house with music. Are your parents doing that too? What type of music are you surrounded with at that time in your life?
Absolutely. It was my brothers. It was, I'm going to say 75% jazz and 25% R&B. I knew when I was 5-6 years old, I knew who Duke Ellington was. I knew who Ahmad Jamal was. I can even see an album cover in my mind's eye, Gerald Wilson's Big Band. That's the kind of background that I got. And also because my brothers played, my oldest brother is a drummer who has played with, I mean, there's some names out there, Jean-Luc Ponty, Santana, Marvin Gaye. He's played with a lot of people. My other brother is musically talented as well. And, you know, I guess listening to the jazz and then seeing those guys play, they played in their high school, in junior high school, groups and stuff. So, you know, there was always instruments around. There were always guys coming in and out. Even when I was 13 years old, I think somewhere around 13, right around the corner, Jimmy Merritt was upright bass player for John Coltrane. And through that, I actually got to meet John Coltrane when I didn't really know who John Coltrane was. I got to meet him. So yeah, it was a cool time.
Yeah, it's amazing. And are your brothers going to live shows and dragging you along at a certain point? Because again, that age gap is just sweet enough where they could really corrupt you good.
Absolutely. My oldest brother, Norman, plays drums. And early on, long before the Me and Mrs. Jones success, he was playing with singer Billy Paul. And Billy out of Philly was before success, was a jazz singer. I mean, a very, very, very good, entertaining jazz singer. And because of that, he had to have really, really good musicians. So once my brother saw that I was really in the bass, he brought me down to the club one night in Philly to meet the bass player. The bass player was Alfonso Johnson. Now, how lucky am I? There's a whole bunch of people in the world that would have loved to have met Alfonso Johnson at the time, but here I am, you know, I'm just given to him. And not only that, he shocked me. He said, "Hey, we got our on the band set. Our drummer's little brother is in the audience, and he's going to come up and play some bass with us." I was like, "What?" Plus, he played fretless, and it was like not a marked fretless. Nice. It was a fretless with no frets on it. Yeah. So he just threw me in the water and you know, I had to swim the best way that I could. And here's a kicker. After Alfonso Johnson left to go work with Woody Herman, his replacement was Anthony Jackson.
Yeah.
So early on, I got to meet, you know, two really, really good guys. And Anthony, I'm friends with both of them, but Anthony and I really, really became super, super tight, close friends.
Okay, so we're going to work a little bit more backwards and then come back, because you dashed a line in there at the beginning of that story, which is a great story, that, you know, when your brother saw that you were really into bass, he took you there. So now fill me in on the gap between trumpet, French horn, somewhat of a prodigy at school, to okay, here's a bass. So how do you first find out about this instrument? What is it? Who gives it to you? What are you thinking about it?
Sure. My next oldest brother, Lathaniel, we call him Nate for short. He was the person, he could play any instrument in an orchestra, and his goal, I guess you could say, was to become like an arranger, Quincy type of person. So he could play everything. Therefore, he had gone to a pawn shop and he bought a bass guitar. It was always sitting around in the basement, basically doing more sitting than anything else. So I come out of elementary school, and over that summer between the sixth and the seventh grade, I grew like 3 or 4 inches. And my basketball interests went through the roof. I decided when I got to junior high school, I wasn't going to say anything about music. I got away with it for a grade before somebody dimed me out and I was put in the orchestra. So all the while, I'll move on further. What happened to bring me to bass? And I'll give you the Cliff's Notes version of this. I got very good in basketball, second team All-State as a senior. Through a very long story, I was deprived of going to college because of a decision that my father made. Rather than just go out and go get a job, I said, well, I've been playing this instrument for 2.5 years. I'm going to make something happen from it. So I got my brother to just write the notes on the fretboard, what they are, because I already knew music. That was no problem. Just tell me, what do I have to do to play a scale? And he wrote all of the notes out. I figured it out. And really, that next day, I played my very first song on bass, which was Time Is Tight by Booker T and the MGs.
Wow. And so at what point is it serious where you're like, I'm buying my own bass, I'm taking this on, or did you sort of lug that thing around forever and ever?
I lugged his bass around until I got in the very, very first local band around there in the neighborhood. And then after his bass, the very first one that I got was a Gibson something or another, because at the time Anthony had one. And if Anthony said, jump up, I jump up. If Anthony said that's how it was at that time, you know, whatever he got, I got, because, he was the first player of his type that I ever saw. So the influence was monumental. But, I got into local group at 17. Shortly after that is when I got my first bass, that Gibson, whatever it was.
That's amazing. So talk a little bit about what happens. So you meet Alfonso, and is it one of those things where it's inspiring you to keep going? Like, at what point are you thinking, this is my profession, this is who I am? Did it happen before that joining of that first local band, or did it take many years for you to feel that way? When did you feel like bass is you?
It actually started as a senior in high school, and I was influenced a whole lot by what my brother, my drummer brother, was doing. You know, the people that he was able to play with, the things that he was doing, the kind of life that he seemed to be living. You know, it's like, whoa, my brother's on planes all the time. He's always on a plane going somewhere to play. And that part of it was inspiring, because I always wanted to get out of Philadelphia. And that seemed like if I wasn't going to play in the National Basketball Association, that seemed like it was a way that that it certainly could happen. And it did in a bigger way than I thought that it ever would.
I don't want to gloss over that, but I've heard you talk about the NBA and mention it before in terms of your athleticism. It's not a toss-away line. Like, you were pretty serious about being in the NBA.
There's no doubt about it. I was definitely going in that direction. As a senior in high school, the coaches selected me as one of the 20 best players in the state of Pennsylvania. And the only reason why it didn't go any farther was because that time, we're talking 1972, colleges were not permitted on paper to pay 100% of a scholarship, only 50%. My father, very practical man, he said, hey, listen, I hear what you're saying. You know, I get it. But if this isn't on paper, we can't do this. Well, Mr. Farrington, you don't understand. No, you don't understand. It's not going to happen. If it's not on paper, he's not going. And that was that.
That's brutal.
Yeah. But you know what? It was meant to be, because if that had not happened, all of the great things that I experienced in music would never have taken place.
I'm curious about, I can't help but my head sort of spinning a little bit around the timing here too, because I'm thinking, you know, I'm younger than you are, thinking about that generation of Woodstock and the 60s and what was happening. How did where you were and what was going on fit into that moment in time? Because you were in the middle of it still.
Yeah, that didn't, because it was largely, as far as Woodstock is concerned, I was raised in, how would I say this? Sort of upper class hood, upper class ghetto. And by that, I mean, you know, you had both parents. Money was coming in. There were no issues. You know, you weren't wearing your brother's sneakers and all that kind of stuff. So it was a cool environment. And no matter where you are in the world, when you're coming up, you are exposed to certain kinds of musics through your environment. And you listen to the radio stations that everybody else is listening to. So for me, my environment, something like Woodstock was on the outskirts. You know, it wasn't something that was very, very relevant, let's say, in our neighborhood, as opposed to going to the Uptown Theater to see a big R&B show.
But even in the bigger movement of things, racial, women's rights, peace in general, that sort of feeling, it wasn't really hitting in your area like that?
For me, it did. I was a little bit unusual, a little different than everybody else. For me, I was always sort of a universal, not West Philadelphia thinking guy. And, you know, to see all of that and to see how the musics were being fused together and people were being fused together and all that kind of thing, it was inspiring. It let me know that a lot of the visions that I had about what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go were going to be a lot easier than I had anticipated 2-3 years prior to that.
One of the bigger career things that happens to you in this journey, and is somewhat earlier component of your journey, is the meeting of Roberta Flack. So how does that come together and how does it evolve into something that became quite substantial?
Yeah. I rewind the tape a little bit. Prior to Roberta, I was working with fusion violinist Michael Urbaniak. And there was a big show over in Europe. And the deal was that we were supposed to go to Marseille and then meet him in Austria. Well, the guys in the band decided that they weren't going to get on that plane and go to Austria. I was the only one that did. My bass got lost. My clothes got lost. I had to spend the night in the airport with Parisian bums in the Orly airport. It was terrible. So, and we never played. After that, when I got home, I said, enough of Urbaniak. And for a second there, I was thinking, enough of music. What happened? A buddy, was it either guitar player Joe Carroll or drummer Steve Jordan, said, hey, Will Lee can't do such and such at Club Mikkel's in New York. You want to do this for 4 or 5 nights? I said, sure, I'm not doing anything. I quit Urbaniak. Okay, great. So one night, this guy walks up to me in the club, and he said, hey, man, I really think you sound great. Oh, thanks. I'm not really paying them any attention because you're a public performer. You hear that, you know, that's the kind of thing that you hear. And he said, listen, I want you to come and audition for my lady. And I'm thinking in my mind, yeah, okay, here we go. Yeah, okay, sure. I'm taking the guy's card. And he said, by the way, her name is Roberta Flack. And I said, the Roberta Flack? He said, yeah, that one. So he said, you'd be at SIR tomorrow at 3 o'clock for an audition. And I went, and that was it.
I mean, that it's an interesting, again, like timings. I always say that, you know, the difference between people is just space and time. And then you got a lot of luck in between that sort of creates these sort of magical moments. And
yeah.
At that time, you're involved with Roberta Flack during what could be considered some of her greatest music songs, like Back Together Again and The Closer I Get to You. What was that like? Was that just sort of like a dramatic change in your life because you're sort of gigging and then it becomes this thing where there's a real responsibility, I guess, as a player and to a musician that people know?
Absolutely. It really was. Even though I had recorded before with Urbaniak, recording with Roberta, that was like the first big exposure thing where you're hearing yourself on the radio all the time. And that was like the first big thing, especially with Back Together Again. I can just recall being in the neighborhood and just hearing myself blaring on car radios and that kind of thing. It was a really, really good special time and important for me because I got a chance with the first album that I did with her, I got a chance to share it with my mentor Anthony and some other good players. So yeah, those will always be very special moments for me. Relationship with Roberta, I mean, she sang at my wedding, played piano at my wedding, paid for the honeymoon, you know, a special lady.
How does a relationship like that end? I'm always curious. We talk always about how it starts and how great it was. And I often always wonder when I hear these stories, like, how does it end? Is it just, you know, you're a session player and the world changes? Is it how does it work?
Well, when I was with Roberta, I wasn't a session player. What it was that she would just have people in the band play on certain tracks on the record because she wasn't in charge of her records. The producers were. So I never, as far as New York is concerned, I was never really in the session. I had sessions, but it wasn't like Will Lee or Marcus or Neil Jason. Those guys had like 7 studios a day, 300 days a week, just ridiculous stuff. But so I wasn't a studio player. I got to play on Roberta's records because I was in the band. And relationships like that, they end for any number of reasons that usually come under the heading of you lied or you stole or you cheated. It's always, you can talk to any one of 5,000 musicians and it's always that.
And is there truth in that or is it often just a way to get the person gone?
it's truth, especially if you are involved in something that's very successful. Then the level of debauchery, we'll say, goes up. And I don't want to attach those things to Roberta, but there's a long story attached to why that particular situation came to an end. And everything is cool today, but during those times, you know, there's always some stuff. And the short and long of it is that we left Roberta to the band that did Back Together Again and The Closer I Get to You. The guys that wrote that were in the band, James M. Toomey and Reggie Lucas. They decided that they wanted to get a production company. And so we broke away from Roberta as a band and for 3-4 years had a pretty successful production company.
But there's an attached story to these people too, right? Because they had a connection to Miles Davis. And I got through listening to another interview of yours, I believe it was with For Bass Players Only, that there's also a learning lesson for you in life in terms of what wound up happening to these people and how you didn't want that to happen to you. Or am I off on that?
No, I'm trying to recall.
They were connected to Miles Davis, these guys, though, right?
Yes. Reggie Lucas, who has since passed away in the last year, and James Ntumi, they were connected with, they worked with Miles Davis in the electric segment of Miles for 6-7 years. And it was Miles who, towards the end of his career, was telling all of the guys in the band that, listen, you're never going to solo like me. You're never going to solo like Charlie Parker. You're never going to do this. That stuff is over. You're not going to be any better than Charlie Parker. So what you do is you get yourself a hit record. And that logic worked on them. Michael Henderson, who I replaced with Roberta Flack, was also in that band. And so those guys came to Roberta with the idea that we somehow going to parlay this into our ultimate dream of having a production company. And so they were successful in that. They pulled us away and led us to believe that this production company was something that was going to be equitable for everyone. And that turned out to not be the truth. And
I'm super curious about what you're also doing to evolve as a player. Anthony Jackson is a beast of a player. Alfonso's a beast of a player. I guess you're floating around the same time as Stanley Clark as well, is there?
Uh-huh.
Is this one of those things where you're constantly in your practice room thinking, I got to keep my game really tight if I'm going to be playing a game? I mean, these are monsters. This isn't like when I was growing up, you know, a couple guys could play some bass lines and you're like, I could do that. I mean, you're really in the midst of a time and a musicianship locally that is just, it's almost insane to think about.
Absolutely. And that was what, even though I worked with somebody on the pop side like Roberta, make no mistake about it, my head was Mahavishnu Orchestra, Weather Report, Return to Forever. That whole thing and all of the great bass players that were involved in all of that, I was constantly practicing, like all the time. And really, it's been just in the last few years that I stopped the constant always practicing. But no doubt about it, I was insane during that time. There were times when I, after a gig, come to the hotel and in the room and practice, because you had all of these records and you're hearing this stuff, and that's the kind of player I want to be like. And I got a chance to get some of those rocks off working with Michael Urbaniak, because their music was very, very difficult. I had to sit with Anthony for 4 or 5 days going over charts to deal with it, because I went to that from Sister Sledge. But no doubt about it, the time period you're speaking of, because of the way that the music was, if your ambitions and your visions were geared in that direction, you had to practice all the time, because, you know, these guys were not taking prisoners.
I can just, like, again, I'm thinking about, to me, practicing in my room and just the sort of level of skill. I mean, you know, it's, I've said it a million times on the podcast and I'll say it again. It's, I'm Canadian. And so when you're a bass player, it was almost like being the goalie on the hockey team. There's just no goalies. You're going to be busy if you're a goalie, you know? But it seemed like in this weird moment in time, that was not the case where you were and where you were evolving. And I mean, it sounds to me as an outsider like so much pressure to be great. I mean, being, you know, sort of jazz, R&B, pop, and having just monsters like that literally breathing down your shoulder, it just feels like like an insane moment.
Yeah, and it's actually a good it's a time that I miss because all of that music was out there, and if you were somebody who was ambitious, you had dreams and so forth. Every day you woke up, you felt like you had something to live for. You know, there was this portion of this track, and you were going to learn this today. You imagine how much better you would feel after you learned it. I remember bass player Miroslav Vitus had the tune Freedom Jazz Dance, and I remember after I learned the line that was in it, you know, just walking around for a week feeling like I owned the world, that kind of thing. You don't have as much of that available these days because that era of music is gone and everything is different. But absolutely, during that was probably the best musical time of life for me. Yeah, no doubt about it.
We had Miroslav on the show. It was such a pleasure to talk to him about that time, and that is just wild. It's time machine, right? It's like you go back in time. It's a time machine. It's amazing. So I've heard you talk about James Jamerson.
Oh yeah.
Which is always interesting to me because an amazing player, it's sort of unfathomable to think of another human being playing on that many amazing songs with those lines. People say to me like, oh, you know, you interview bass players, what's that about? I'm like, if you sat down and just went through, like you could put a James Jamerson playlist together on Apple Music and be busy your whole life. So he impacts you. Who else impacts you? And I'm also curious, if you can think back to being the age you're at where you're really thinking about people like James Jamerson, how do you see his playing? Is it one of those things where you're like, I see what he did, but I see where I want to go? How does it impact your style and thinking around the bass?
I didn't even know who Jamerson was. When I got to know Anthony, I asked him who his guys were, and Jamerson was the first person. And he told me, He said, yeah, you've heard all of the Motown records because they don't have credits on the record. You just didn't know who he was. But that's my guy, and I would suggest that, you know, you go check him out. Get the album, the Love Child album, and learn every note on that album, and then you'll know Jamerson. So at that time, I really hadn't done anything yet. My goal was to just try and be as much like Anthony as could be. So if he had said, hey, man, you want to be a great bass player, brush your teeth 23 times a day, then I'm a brusher my teeth 23 times a day. So I didn't have my own goal or vision about what I wanted to sound like. I just wanted to be as good as someone like Anthony. So therefore, the things that he said to do, that's what I did, and that's what led me to Jamerson. And after a while, I developed my own love for him and the realization of the genius in his playing, where if, let's say, if there's a tune that has C major 7 for one bar and D minor 7 for one bar, a typical old head jazz player is going to play the C, maybe the 5th, the G, maybe the 4th, and then when the chord moves up on the D, maybe the 5th, maybe the 4th. But Jamerson is going to give you that major 7th in there. He's going to give you all kinds of embellishments on that chord, almost arpeggiating it before it changes. And that was the beautiful, beautiful thing about him. He would just be playing all over the place, too busy for most producers, but half steps. It can be summarized by that terminology. Jamerson was a half step guy. And when you listen to some other guys, I'm not going to name any names because then somebody's going to think I'm trashing them. But there are very, very successful players, jazz players. They don't use that style because they're not, they just don't use the half steps. So if the chord is a C something, they're playing a C. And not the kinds of things that Jamerson would play, at least not in popular music. Now, in jazz, that's a different thing. But Jamerson, He taught you those half steps and also to think more about chords as a bass player than what's normal. You know, so if somebody has, say, a C7 flat 9 from the Jamerson School, I'm going to get that flat 9 in there somewhere. And not it's not just going to be for the piano or the guitar or the chordal instrument. So, yeah, for me, it was his whole position of playing and thinking about what's in the chord and how you can embellish it and take advantage of that and move the band along and all that stuff.
Do you mentioned it a bit earlier, but you there's this sort of sentimental feeling that it's hard not to be attached to when you tell these stories of these players who really wanted to do something as bass players to the songs, which again, you know, prior to people like Jamerson, it wasn't really that type of thinking. There were some standouts, but not many. And I think about the instrument now, and I think about things like YouTube and watching some bass players play or just sort of walking down the aisles at NAMM on any given year, and you're just like, wow, this instrument has really evolved and changed in a dramatic way. And because of the change in music too, it seems like it's moved in a different direction. I don't want to say away from songs or musicality, and maybe you might, but it's an interesting evolution for this instrument, isn't it?
It is, and you don't want to say it, but I will. It has moved, excuse me, it has moved away from musicality, and I don't know whether it's because songs are no longer as important or if it was just a natural progression, but because the dominant playing mode on bass guitar now is slapping. Slapping is, and I do it, I have it on a lot on my my CD. Because it's more of a technique as opposed to something that's musical, you know, and because it's so dominant, you can walk into a music store and see virtuoso 10-year-old slappers, you know, that can do things that guys who make their living playing a bass can't do. And that's because it's a technique. You ask that same kid to solo through giant steps. First of all, what's giant steps? And secondly, solo? Well, what, you know, that's the way that goes. The instrument has definitely evolved. There are a lot of really, really great things going on. Huh. When I was starting, a guy like Victor Wooten was around, the guy that can do all of the great technical and musical things that he can do. I mean, it was just, it was unheard of at that time. It has definitely evolved. I'm not sure that things have gotten better. And I'm not one of those old guys who goes around saying that.
Back in my day.
Yeah, back in my day, and things used to be that, you know, that's just not the way things go. You know, things evolve. If you like things so much back in your day, you know, put that car away and use a horse and buggy. You know, don't give yourself a, get rid of Wi-Fi, you know. So, things have not evolved musically, at least as not as far as the bass guitar is concerned. They've evolved in terms of flash, I think. And there's a lot of things that players are doing now that were unheard of back then. But, as far as being musical is concerned, that much of it has not, that hasn't evolved. It's sort of sad.
I want to jet forward to today a little bit, and I've heard a couple things about you. I'm curious if they're true and how you feel about them. One is no more travel, that you do not play live, that it's sort of not what you do. So I'm curious, like, true on both of those, and why?
I'm not interested in playing live unless it's at a certain level. If I got a certain call, you know, like from a, if I got a call from someone and it was worthwhile financially. The level of it was worthwhile and everything. You know, I'm going to do that, but I'm not that much interested in doing anything that's reminiscent of when I first started. When I first started, Philly, when I first started, I think I went something like 2.5, almost 3 years of never not having a weekend to work. Those kinds of places don't even exist anymore. So when I say I'm not interested in playing live, I really, what I'm leaving out is, unless it's a certain level, you know, Phil Collins calls, I'm gone. Chick Corea calls, I'm gone. But I'm not interested in playing like the local clubs and where people don't really pay attention to the music and that kind of thing. And what was the other question? That was the
travel. Well, that fits into that answer, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I would not mind traveling, you know, if the price was right. And it really more more than anything else is I have a physical problem with a leg where I'm not walking as spryly as I was, you know, when I was 22. And so that part of it makes it a little bit difficult. But you're right. It does tie into the other thing because, trust me, if Mick Jagger called and my man decided he didn't want to make a tour, I'm doing it. I'm on that plane. I'm doing whatever it is that they want to do because sometimes you can work with somebody and at least temporarily what happens as a result of it is life changing. And like the Stones, that would be one of those things financially and otherwise that would really be worthwhile. But you don't want to go out after all this experience and travel and stuff that I've done, you don't want to go out with somebody and worry about the same kind of crap. Am I going to get paid and that kind of stuff?
How am I going to sleep? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and doubling up with a guy who, you know, that just doubling up period is bad, but you always get the one guy who can't sleep without snoring, you know, no.
I hear you. Let's talk about the area where it feels like you've been amping up a lot. And that feels to me like teaching is a big thing for you or mentoring or helping.
It is in every direction, in any way that I can. I mean, I'm one of those guys that at the stoplight, when the guy's standing there with the cigar box and he's looking for some money, I'm one of the guys that's always putting money out. I try as much as I can. There is a charter school in Delaware that I take part in. I try as much as I can to help students there with their goals. I have people calling me constantly, a lot, which is surprising, you know, because my name is not. You know, it's not Ron Carter, Stanley Clark, Marcus Miller. All those guys respect me and everything, but it's not a huge name like theirs. But nevertheless, people know some of the things that I've done. So anytime I can give advice to anyone, a player, I'm doing that. Anytime I can help them with anything, you know, I like to help people and, you know, that's my deal. But really, with the bass players, I always try and talk to them about being musical, you know, because it may feel good right now to, like, pop your butt off and everything and make everybody go, ooh, ah, ah. But if you want a career, it really is best for you to be musical, because if you're not, at some point, what you're doing that's popular, might be popular right now, you get to be an older guy and you're playing and that stuff isn't happening anymore. And you're waiting for that phone call that never comes.
Yeah. I know that we're sensitive for time here and I want to be respectful of your time, but I don't want to end the conversation and not talk about this album you did called Looking Straight Ahead.
Mm-hmm.
With the band name being, and I hope I get this right, Camarigiano. Is that right? Camarigiano?
It's actually... there's a story to that. It's Camerigiano, and actually, okay. It's not the band. My oldest son's name is Amir, and my youngest son's name is Kijano. So when you put it together, you've got Camerigiano.
You're probably one of the few people that'll be able to pronounce it, though, correct?
And that's an honor of my love and respect and honor of my kids.
But an amazing piece of work, people like Omar Hakim and Frank Gambale. What were you trying to do with this?
That is a very good question. You couldn't have asked a better question. The reputation that I have is largely based on music that does not display the full gamut of what I'm able to do or my interests. People know me for Back Together Again, Stephanie Mills is What You're Gonna Do With My Lovin', and things like that. That, you know, they're great tunes, the parts on them are cool. But before I started playing that music, I had some ideas for myself as to where I wanted to go as a player, and those gigs and things, they did not allow me to express that. Urbaniak did a bit, but otherwise, the things that people really know me for, you know, are not, they don't give a full display of what I can do. So I decided that I wanted to do a record that showed that I'm not only an R&B place bass player, or only a fusion bass player, or only this, or only that. That, you know, I'm versatile as a player. I'm versatile as a composer. I mean, who else has a hip hop song and Giant Steps on the same record? You know. So the whole goal on doing the record was just to give more of an idea of what I'm capable of, and the hope in the end, I really like to get into production, but one thing at a time.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there was a, when I was listening to it, I could feel the love. Like there's, you know, sometimes you hear a song or two and there's a focus and like, I'll throw an album together. But this album really had, like, from top to bottom, a lot of love in it.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It was, you know, important to me because there were lots and lots and lots and lots of times when I did a session or something when I basically had to play what someone else's idea was of what needed to go on that track. And so during this, not having somebody say, well, you're doing that, you're doing this, you're doing too much, you're doing too little, can you do this, can you do that? To not have that, and also to just have the freedom to be able to do what I wanted. Absolutely, there was a lot of love in it. It was recorded over a pretty wide period of time. I think the very first tune I did, one of the ones with Frank Gambale on it, goes all the way back to like 2008 or so. And, you know, it's a fusion piece, Odd Meter, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, absolutely, it was a lot of love, especially for certain songs, that On Fire being one of them, because Frank did it in one take, and that he could, you know, you give a tune to somebody and they don't know you, that he could love it up the way that he did it. I tell you, it was a good while for me listening to that tune when I could listen to it and not tear up when Frank solos. It just, his passion, it's like, wow, a guy like that was into my tune. It's like, woo, you know, really, really made me feel good. So that's a good observation on your part. There was definitely a lot of love.
That's great. So total pleasure speaking with you, and so many more journeys that we could probably talk about. Basil, let people know, like, can they connect with you somehow? Do you have a website, social media? Where do you have people connect with you?
You can find me. I'm very much a social media person. The best place to get me would probably be Facebook. I'm also on Instagram.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for my pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor when somebody cares about what you have to say.